From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, lawyers, law students, and judges show what happens at the Sacramento Inn of Court. It's a place where legal issues are dramatized and then discussed. Also, the music of Vieux Farka Touré, the African singer-guitarist who's coming to Grass Valley, and the story of King Records, a relatively little-known but also influential American record label. But first, one of Sacramento's most famous restaurants, Frank Fats, is celebrating 70 years of Chinese food, banana cream pie, and political deal-making. Just a couple of blocks from the state capitol building, Fats is a place where political compromises and plans have been hatched in back booths and even, most famously, on the back of a napkin. We're going to talk with one of those political deal-makers in a few minutes, but first, Jerry Fatt, president of the Fatt Family Business. Jerry, welcome to Insight.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Thank you for having me on.
Why did Frank Fatt open his restaurant just a couple of blocks from the Capitol? Did he want to be close to the Capitol, or was that just where he happened to find a place?
I think that's where he happened to be find a place. I never asked him, but at the time in 1939, L Street was a very, he said it was a poor street. It was almost Skid Road. And he found an old Italian speakeasy restaurant that I assume he got for a good price, and that's where he started in 1939.
Did it start out serving Chinese food?
Yes. It was always, in fact, I brought a couple, we have some copies of our, I think, original menus. It was always a little bit of Chinese-American, and over the years, besides the, you know, we specialize in Cantonese cooking, but we've evolved over the years, but I don't know exactly when, but he did add some American food, and one of the other things we're famous for over the years is our famous steaks.
Did politicians start coming to Frank Fatt's right away? Do you know?
I don't think it was immediate. My dad did work at Hung King Lum restaurant in the old Sacramento Chinatown on 3rd and I. That was our cousin. And I think he started in the kitchen and worked his way up as a server. And I think he did develop a clientele at Hung King Lum restaurant, which may have, you know, a few of the politicians. And eventually, you know, when they heard that my dad was going to open a new restaurant, they went over to visit his new place.
We're talking about the 70th anniversary of Sacramento's Frank Fatt's restaurant, just a couple of blocks from the state capitol. It's a very well-known restaurant in political circles. On the phone is Willie Brown, former Speaker of the California Assembly and former Mayor of San Francisco. He was a frequent patron of Frank Fatt's in his many years in Sacramento. Willie Brown, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you.
Why was Frank Fatt's so popular with politicians?
Well, first and foremost, it was very, very convenient. Secondly, just absolutely excellent food. The brandy fried chicken, the banana cream pie, the chocolate pie, you know, the Frank Fatt's New York style steak, and all of the wonderful Chinese cuisine. That made it very easy for those of us who were displaced for three or four nights a week in Sacramento doing the people's business.
What are your memories of Frank Fatt himself? What was he like with people like you and other well-known politicians who went to his restaurant?
Well, I can tell you right off the bat, it was the most trusted confidant that you could possibly have. He was a repository of knowledge, but he shared very little of it to the detriment or the embarrassment of any particular member. Members so trusted the Fatt family that the once-a-week poker game that we did, the only non-legislator permitted were a member of the Fatt family.
When you and Bill Lockyer and others went to Frank Fatt's, did you have a special table or a special part of the restaurant that you went to?
There is a speaker's booth. That is the booth at the end of the bar on the left, just before you enter the first dining room. However, on the occasion of the napkin deal, that was done upstairs.
Well, tell us about the napkin deal. Is there some legend nowadays that's attached to that, or is the story, as we've heard, that you and Bill Lockyer and others solved a political problem on the back of a napkin?
That is a totally and completely accurate. We did solve a political problem involving the trial lawyers, the insurance industry, and some consumer advocates, and it was stalled in literally in both houses. But Lockyer being a lawyer and my being a lawyer and having credibility with all parties, we were allowed to help orchestrate a solution.
Why was this done at the Frank Fats restaurant? Was it deliberately moved there so as to get away from the Capitol building, or did you all just happen to be there?
No. We just happened to be there. We went there for dinner and to continue the dialogue and the talking. And what you must be prepared to do is, when you can seal the deal, no matter where you are, seal the deal. And that's how it happened.
I'm talking with Willie Brown, former Speaker of the California Assembly, a frequent patron of Frank Fats Restaurant, which celebrates its 70th anniversary today. There was a law change in 1974 which restricted the amount that lobbyists could spend on meals with lawmakers. What impact did that have on the culture of the Capitol and, by extension, at Frank Fats?
Well, it changed it dramatically, because before that time, almost every member of the legislature in one fashion or another would eat once or twice a week at Frank Fats, and they were usually the guest of some special interest organization, whether it was the insurance industry, the medical industry, or the city industries, you name it, or the legal cities, supervisors association. There was always somebody who wanted to treat people who held a public office, and legislators operating on very minimal salaries availed themselves of these invitations. When Jerry Brown came along with his proposal to limit the spending to $10 a person, it had a profound impact on the social activities surrounding the legislature.
And was that, on the whole, a good thing, a bad thing, or mixed?
Well, it was a mixed, because the legislation moves as much with acquaintanceship and knowledge and relationships as it does with the merit of the legislation itself. And you notice that you're in a stalemate position these days in Sacramento. That didn't happen overnight. That happened over a number of years, probably commencing with the changes in 1974.
Willie Brown, do you think that the lawmakers of today at the legislature are convening informally at Frank Fats or other restaurants and talking with each other in a more informal setting, as you and Bill Lockyer and others did in the past?
I don't think that there is that much camaraderie, because people don't really get a chance to know each other. Term limits has made it such a short experience. It's not like it can be a career experience. You can build and learn, and you have institutional memory. None of that exists in Sacramento today. Term limits have robbed people of that, and I would suspect that there's very little business being done by members of the legislature outside of the halls of the legislature, simply because they don't even recognize each other.
On the menu at Frank Fats, it now says, please set your cell phone to silent mode. Was that an issue when you were there? Probably not. And in any case, if you were still there, what would you make of cell phones and texting, which happens all over the place, including in political circles?
Well, I think cell phones and text messaging is damaging, simply because you never get the full explanation of the content of the message, and that's unfortunate. No, cell phones didn't exist during the time that I served in the legislature. They became a reality sometimes in the 90s, and I'd already moved on to San Francisco as the mayor.
Willie Brown, former Speaker of the California Assembly, former mayor of San Francisco. He was a frequent patron of Frank Fats Restaurant, which celebrates its 70th anniversary today. Willie Brown, thank you so much for talking with us today.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Jerry Fatt, remind us who Frank Fatt was.
My dad was an immigrant that came over around 1916 to the United States for his grandfather sent him over to the United States to enjoy a better life, or in search of a better life. His grandfather sent him over. He came over as a, in those times, a paper son. He was stationed in Angel Island, the immigration center, for a month, and then traveled throughout the United States, ended up in Sacramento because we had a cousin, or he had a cousin here, which was the old Hung Kin Lum restaurant on 3rd and I Street. And he worked there for many years, did odd jobs. He also got a job at the Sutter Club as a dishwasher and saved up some money. And the story was there was Chinese Kino tickets being run in those days. And my one of the patrons at Hung Kin Lum restaurant gave my dad some money to run the numbers. And it was a winning ticket. And my dad didn't see that patron for a couple months, came back, and my dad held the money for him and says, "Hey, you won whatever amount of money." The patron eventually helped my dad look for a place to to own, which was Frank Fats, and loaned him the money to get started. So that's how Frank Fats started.
What did Frank make of the unique role that his restaurant played in California's political life?
I don't think he set out one to be part of the politics of California. I think it just evolved. As Willie mentioned, I think my dad, his personality, besides your basic tenets of good food, good service, and not disclosing any secrets that happened there, my dad treated everybody equally, whether you were a legislature, the governor, high-ranking official, or just the local state employee or local businessman in Sacramento. He treated everybody the same, and I think that was what people respected about him.
Why did he introduce that famous Chinese dish, banana cream pie, onto the menu of Frank Fats?
I think it wasn't my dad. I think it was one of our first or second chef that worked for us he knew, and I don't know the complete story, that had a recipe or something similar to banana cream pie. And my dad, again, the menu was kind of a Chinese-American menu, so it became suddenly famous over the years. And to this day, almost all new restaurants in Sacramento have a banana cream pie, but I would have to say we were the original one that introduced it.
Jerry, there's a celebration tonight, I guess, of the anniversary?
Yes, we are having a 70th anniversary party at Frank Fats on L Street. But this year we decided to have it as a benefit for Sacramento Crisis Nursery. And the reason we picked Sacramento Crisis Nursery is they have a same family value philosophy as the Fat family that my dad instilled in with our family. And so we picked them to be the beneficiary of some of the proceeds from this event tonight.
Jerry Fant, president of the Fant Family Business. We've been talking about the 70th anniversary of the family's flagship restaurant, Frank Fant's, which is being celebrated today, a place where a lot of political deal-making has been done over the years. Jerry, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. And I want to just remind you, I bought our famous whole banana cream pie made fresh this morning, so it's for you and your staff.
Oh, we will assuredly enjoy it. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the Sacramento Inn of Court, a modern take on a medieval institution. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can download Insight details at capradio.org/insight. Coming up in Talk of the Nation, NPR's political junkie on the week's top political news and scuttlebutt, including the president's healthcare address to Congress this evening, and Van Jones, the East Bay activist resigning under fire from his green jobs position in the Obama administration. Plus, how secure is your email account given that your password can probably be bought online for about $100? That's what we hear. That's Talk of the Nation after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. Inns of Court started centuries ago in England. A modern version of them lives on, including in Sacramento at McGeorge School of Law. It's a place where lawyers, judges, and law students gather to dramatize and then discuss ethical legal issues. We're going to hear one of those dramatizations or an excerpt in just a little bit. But first of all, let's talk more generally about the Inn of Court, specifically the Kennedy Inn of Court in Sacramento. One of our guests is Tani Cantal Sakayui, who's Associate Justice in the Court of Appeal, 3rd Appellate District, and President of the Kennedy Inn of Court. Tani, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
What happens at the Inn of Court?
What happens at the Inn of Court is a wonderful learning experience where the lawyers and judges and students of the Sacramento and greater legal community get together and teach each other about the highest virtues of professionalism, ethics, and civility in the practice of law. And we do it by performing skits that emphasize ethical questions or civility questions.
Are the skits meant to add fun to the event, or do they actually have a real serious point to them?
Well, I would answer that question with 2 points. The skits have a very serious point because it raises an ethical issue or an issue of concern, a professional issue in the practice of law. But since it happens at Tuesday night, 7 p.m. to 8:45, it has an entertainment value as well.
Also with us is Arthur Scotland, presiding justice in the Court of Appeal, 3rd Appellate District. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
As a judge, what do you get out of the Inn of Court?
Well, every session is just a wonderful learning experience. The thing that I think is most important is that there's a great misperception in the public about what attorneys do and what judges do. And our group shows the best of the best. We work very hard to promote civility, ethics, and professionalism in the practice of law. And each time I go and learn something new, and it's just an invigorating experience, particularly the discussion among the members after the skits.
Give us a couple of examples of the kinds of issues that could be brought up in the Inn of Court?
We have a wide range of issues. We are an award-winning program. We have won awards for the last 14 years as one of the top inns in the nation, and there are over 500 inns in the nation. And for 14 consecutive years, we have won best programs of the year. This program that won for this year talks about the change of communication, email, text messaging, websites, and how that affects the practice of law and how we have to be very careful, risk management, about some of the perils from that type of communication. We've had other programs that talk about overzealous advocacy. We've had programs about attorney advertising, any number of very interesting issues that raise ethical issues.
We're talking about the Kennedy Inn of Court, which is based in Sacramento and brings together judges, lawyers, law students to dramatize and then discuss legal issues. Also with us is a third-year student at McGeorge School of Law who participates in this. She's Katie Matisich. Katie, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, what about law students? What do you get out of it?
Well, I think as a law student, we have a different perspective, and it's a great way to connect and with the Sacramento legal community, and I've learned a lot so far. You know, we meet with our team, and it's a creative process where we kind of discuss the ideas that come up in the legal profession. And as a law student, we have a different perspective, given that we haven't practiced law yet, but we were learning things in the classroom and sort of seeing it from a theoretical perspective. And I think that collaborative process really is a great way to learn about these issues that come up within the law.
Well, before the show started, you and some of your colleagues recorded a brief skit,
yes,
which is
yes,
to dramatize a legal issue. Before we listen to it, how long would a skit typically be?
Typically, a skit runs, I believe, over an hour, because as part of the skit, again, we have a moderator, and that moderator leads discussion and brings up questions and issues for the audience. So it runs over an hour, but the scene today, I believe, is about 3 minutes.
Anything quickly that any of you would like to say about the scene we're about to hear, just to put it in context? Anything we need to know, or is it self-standing?
Well, just to give you a little bit of perspective, it's going to be some law students who are talking about some interviews they're about to have.
Okay, well, let's listen to it.
Sarah, I got your usual venti frappe, one pump vanilla, sugar-free, with extra whip and 2 shots.
Thanks, but I'm just not up for it today.
You? Not up for coffee? You're kidding, right?
No, I just don't think I should have caffeine. You know, Mark and I are hoping that this is the month.
Are you serious? I thought you decided that law school wasn't the best time for that. And you just landed a job interview next week.
Yeah, but tell me when it is a good time. First, it's law school, then the bar, then my first job. 80-hour work weeks, before you know it, I'll be old, like 40. And what good am I then?
Whatever. 40 is the new 30. And lots of women are getting pregnant at 40. But I know what you mean. Law isn't the most inviting place for motherhood. That is why I'm doing the Sotomayor thing. No kids. Nothing that will tie us down.
Come on, you can't be serious. You don't ever want kids?
Nope, not us. You just can't have it all. Sotomayor didn't get to be a Supreme Court justice at 54 by taking Jimmy and Janie to soccer practices.
Who says you can't have it all? Look at the pit bull with lipstick, governor, and a bunch of kids.
Yeah, but what is she now? An up-and-coming blogger? But really, who's going to hire you, knowing that you're going to need time off in 9 months?
Hey, Sarah and Michael are here. Look, don't say anything about this to them.
Guess what? Drew proposed.
Proposed? You've been dating for what? 2 months now?
It was so romantic.
What? Did he take you to the back shelf of the library where they keep the shepherds and then ask you to make some subsequent history with him?
Liz, that's so exciting. Well, let's see the ring.
I didn't wear it today.
Didn't wear it? What? Was it from a Cracker Jack box or something?
No, I just have an interview today, and I didn't want to give the wrong impression.
Since when is wearing an engagement ring giving the wrong impression?
Well, they'll see the ring, and then they'll know I'll be planning a wedding and that I'll need time for a honeymoon.
Even worse, they'll assume that you need some time off so you can pop out some babies. Good call, Liz. Babies are a definite deal breaker.
Oh, please. It's not like lawyers can't have babies.
Sure we can. Just not lawyers who don't have a job yet.
You three are out of control. You have it all wrong. I, for one, am going to wear a ring for my interview. Pop it on my ring finger and bam, I'm a stable family man. Yep, the ring does wonders for an interview.
Yeah, maybe for a man.
Like a ring is really going to save you, Mike? What do you have in the personal interest section of your resume? Most consecutive shots of tequila? Not exactly what they're looking for.
Even better, I've included tennis and the original lawyer's hobby, golf.
Mike, you don't do either of those things.
Nope, but I've watched enough ESPN to talk the talk. It's not like anyone is honest on their resume anyway. I mean, look at Kristen. I bet you don't say that every Friday you go to Starbucks and sing for open mic night.
Well, of course not. I don't need people thinking I'm a weak, emotional girl.
Yeah, and I didn't put Women Lawyers Society on my resume either. I don't want them to think I'm a feminist who won't flirt a little when it counts.
Let's face it, our resumes are just all a pathetic attempt to look like the perfect candidate. And if you're lucky, like me, it works.
Speaking of the perfect candidate, Sarah, did you finally change your cell number? You've been living in the 916 for 3 years now. That 714 area code on your resume just screams, once I get a job in the OC, I'm out of here.
Hey, that isn't true. We're definitely here for good. We just haven't changed our cell numbers because it's a hassle.
Then get a landline. You just better change it if you want a job in Sacramento. Then again, we all know that landing a job isn't your big priority anyway, Miss Pragers.
That skit was recorded before our show. It includes several students at McGeorge School of Law, and they're part of the Inn of Court, the Kennedy of Inn of Court, which is a forum where lawyers, judges, and law students dramatize legal issues and then discuss them. And one of those students that you heard there is in our studio, Katie Matisich. Katie, how pressing a problem is this that was discussed there for women law students?
I think
it's a very demanding job being a lawyer for the most part.
It is a demanding job. I think it's gotten better over time, but I think it's still an issue that comes up that needs to be discussed as we move forward, especially in this economy. I think that the factors at play are a little bit more relevant and pressing.
Tani Kentel Sakayue, are there double standards even for women lawyers?
I can certainly say that the issue that the law students raise in this skit are issues that face women lawyers, women judges, and even to some extent, I would say male lawyers, because it's about starting a family. It's about the ethical questions when you prepare a resume to get a job, to transfer a job, to apply for a judgeship. I mean, I knew a story once. I knew a situation where a lawyer was pregnant, applying for a judgeship, but didn't want to let people know that she was pregnant because, after all, that would mean could she perform her duties and would she need time off?
Well, it's kind of ironic that here were lawyers worrying about the law.
Yes. Lawyers worrying about the law and trying to cast, in this particular instance, trying to make themselves the perfect candidate for that perfect job. The ethical issues that are raised, the professional issues that are raised, all about getting that perfect job in the law.
Tani Cantel Sakayue is Associate Justice in the Court of Appeal, 3rd Appellate District, and President of the Kennedy Inn of Court. Arthur Scotland, why is it called Kennedy Inn of Court?
It's named after Anthony Kennedy. He was one of the three founding members of our inn when he was a circuit judge here in Sacramento. He then, of course, went on to the United States Supreme Court. He and Judge Milton Schwartz and Dean Gordon Schaber of McGeorge School of Law formed the organization in 1988, and it's been an award-winning success ever since.
Now, I know inns of court have a long, long history, but can you give us just a brief description of where they came from?
Well, they came from England originally, in which seasoned practitioners of the law would help and instruct the younger practitioners to become ethical and effective advocates for their clients. Many years ago, the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court felt that this was such an excellent educational experience, it should be replicated in the United States, and that spawned the Inn of Court movement. Since then, it's caught on quite well across the nation and has been very successful.
What did lawyers, young lawyers, law students do before this movement restarted or started in the United States to informally discuss legal issues and ethics?
It was very difficult to be able to do that because as a young lawyer, you didn't have access to judges and senior attorneys in the community to be able to share these ideas. Frankly, there just was not a way to interact as we are able to do. And it's not just the younger attorneys learning from older attorneys and judges. I must say that every time I learn something from them as well, it's just a unique experience.
You're one of the most well-known people in Sacramento's legal community. Do you ever pick up the script and read a character yourself?
Well, we all do cameos from now and then, and it's a lot of fun, I must say. We also have the Hammy Awards, where we do award people for their contributions to the programs, not only acting, but contributions to the discussion and the focus on ethics. The program that was just taped is just one aspect of some of the various ethical issues that face attorneys.
And Tani, in a typical Inn of Court meeting, after you've done the skit, what happens then? Is there someone who's actually in charge and says, okay, let's talk about this, let's analyze it, or is it more informal where people just sit around a table and talk?
Well, absolutely, there's a process. There's a team, and the team leader is a judicial master who's a judge. In this case, it's Judge Elena Duarte. So when the skit is over, the lights go up in the audience, and she stands and she asks a question, and the 99 of us in the audience raise our hands and speak to issues that we think were produced by the skit. And then people feed off of the answers and responses of everyone else in the audience. And people speak freely. People speak from their heart. Some people plant a question or plant an answer to sort of rile up the audience because what happens in the inn stays in the inn. And so people speak very freely about experiences.
And finally, Katie, what kind of lawyer are you planning to be?
Good question. I'm a third-year student, so I have a few months, and then I'm taking the bar. And so far, it looks like I'm going to be doing civil practice, but we'll see. I've got to figure that out.
Good. Well, good luck to you. And thank you all for joining us today, as well as the people who participated in the skit that we recorded beforehand. Katie Matisich is a third-year student at McGeorge School of Law. Also with us, Arthur Scotland, presiding justice in the Court of Appeal, 3rd Appellate District, and Tani Cantel Sakayue, associate justice in the court, and president of the Kennedy Inn of Court. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the music of African singer-guitarist Vieux Farka Touré. We'll talk with his manager, a woman with strong local ties. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight happens in part because of the work of interns. If you'd like to be considered for an Insight internship or know someone who would, get details at the careers page at capradio.org/insight. African singer-guitarist Vieux Farka Touré is touring the U.S. and comes to Grass Valley this week. If he sounds familiar, perhaps it's because of his famous family name. Vieux's father was the late singer-guitarist Ali Farka-Touré. Like his father, Vieux's guitar style is a soulful, finger-picking African blues. Here's an example. This is Sherry Lee from his album Fondo. Song Sherry Lay from Vieux Farka-Touré's album Fondo. Joining us by phone from Eugene, Oregon, where he's on tour, is Vieux Farka-Touré's manager, a woman with strong ties to Nevada City. She's Deborah Cohen. Deborah, welcome.
Hi, Jeffrey. How you doing?
I'm doing well. You know, Vieux, as many people know, is the French word for old. Why did Ali Farka-Touré call his son old?
Actually not Ali, it's an honorific tradition in Mali. Vieux's real name, his given name is Burema, which is his grandfather's name. And out of respect for the elders, he is not called by that name. He is called Vieux, the old guy, as a reference to his grandfather. So it's a pretty common nickname, actually. But it is strange for a 28-year-old.
Yeah, he doesn't look very Vieux.
And he doesn't act it either.
You have long ties to the Farka-Touré family because, as well as being manager of Vieux, you also managed his father, Ali. How did you get involved with the family?
I did. I started working as a tour manager for Ali Farka-Touré in about 1999 and worked with him for the last 7 years of his life and toured with him all over the world.
How did you meet him?
It was pure serendipity. I was working a concert in Montreal and sort of switching back from French to English, and his booking agent ran up to me in a panic and said, "Oh my God, we just got a cancellation from our tour manager for Ali Farka-Touré's next tour 2 weeks from now. Can you do it? I heard you speak French." And I thought for about a split second and said, I would pay to work with Ali Farka-Touré. I didn't need any more encouragement than that, so I jumped on it. And I don't know, you know, it was one of those meetings, destiny, whatever you want to call it. We were family from the first day we met. And he invited me to Mali after that, and I went and met his entire extended family, and including Vieux. And that was that. History was written.
When Ali Farka-Touré died, did you think that was it? Your connection to the family?
No, absolutely not. Over the years, my ties with his family, the family friends, and what in that wonderfully warm African tradition is the extended family. You have multitudinous aunts, uncles, cousins, brothers everywhere you go. So now when I go back to Mali, which is usually two or three times a year, it is like going home. I have a true family there, and I have deep lifelong friendships for sure. And of course now I have the professional relationship with Vieux, which I inherited.
Deborah Cohen is manager of African singer-guitarist Vieux Farka-Touré. He's at Grass Valley Center for the Arts tomorrow night. Perhaps it's just me, but I hear a continuation from the music of Ali Farka-Touré into the music of Vieux Farka-Touré. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's a 28-year-old kid, and he listens, you know, he has an iPod stuck in his ears all day long and listens to music from all over the world. It's pretty incredible. His tastes range from Bhangra to punk, indie rock, reggae, whatever. But he is a true Malian in the sense he has a foot so firmly planted in the traditions, in the musical traditions of Mali. And, of course, he learned from his father to respect those traditions. So there will always be, I think, a lifeline of hearing Ali's music, which was, I think, probably one of the world's greatest representatives of a world music tradition.
Let's listen to another song by Vieux Farka-Touré. This is also from his latest album, Fondo. The song is called Fafa.
Thank you.
In the music, it sounds like an African blues. Is this the way the music sounded that led to the blues, or has African music been in turn influenced by American blues?
Well, Ali Faka Touré was probably the first really vocal proponent of the theory that, you know, we Americans need to listen to our blues and think back to where that came from. And what he always said about his music and about Malian music in general is, it may sound like blues to you guys, but it's our traditional music. So think about the roots of your blues.
Deborah Cohen, manager of African singer-guitarist Vieux Farka Touré. Deborah, you have a strong connection to this area, specifically Nevada City.
Because of your,
your late brother, Utah Phillips. You spent several years living with Utah when he was not doing so well.
I'd been living and working in Brazil, actually, prior to that. And when he was finally diagnosed officially with congestive heart failure, I kind of felt a heart tug of my own and came back and kept on touring, but was primarily based out of Nevada City so that we could be closer physically. We've always been kind of joined at the hip mentally, which is a very scary thing to think about. You talk about Utah Phillips. And yeah, so for about I came back in 98 and spent those years basically based out of Nevada City.
When he died, the reaction and the impact on people in Nevada City and the whole surrounding area was quite extraordinary. And I guess you saw what that was going to be like when you were staying in Nevada City with Utah.
I got an inkling of it, but I have to admit that because I've spent so many, basically since 1975, I've lived pretty much outside of the United States, in France, the UK, Brazil, sort of all over, and traveled so much, I hadn't quite recognized the full scope of the impact of his footprint on the earth. I mean, when, as you said, I mean, in the Nevada City region, when we held the memorial service, and not only thousands of people came from the Nevada County region, people came from all over the country, and obituaries were written in newspapers in Scotland and Australia, and Switzerland and France, and I mean, you know, he was huge, and I think he's one of those rare human beings whose imprint will get larger with time. He was an extraordinary guy.
Deborah, you obviously travel a lot. Where do you actually live?
Let's see. I have an email address, and I have a cell phone right now. I am currently homeless. I gave up my last apartment in Lisbon, Portugal, last December, when I realized that I had actually spent, since the month of May preceding, I had spent a total of 3 weeks in my apartment there. I figured rent was probably not a smart option.
Yes.
I've basically been traveling pretty much since then. I spent 3 months in Mali, and we've been pretty much on tour since then. Vieux does about 8 months a year now on the road, and I like to be there at least for sort of, you know, the big principal shows.
And right now you're in Eugene, you're heading south. Vieux Farka Touré is at Grass Valley Center for the Arts tomorrow night. Deborah Cohen is his manager. She spent many years living in Nevada City. Deborah, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Jeffrey. It's been really nice talking to you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a Sacramento author's new book on one of America's most influential record labels. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Did you really like something on Insight? Tell us what it was and why at insight@capradio.org. A new book by a Sacramento author tells the story of a relatively little known but influential record label called King Records. The book is called King of the Queen City, and the author is John Hartley Fox. He's in our studio. John, welcome to Insight.
Thank you for inviting me, Jeffrey.
Why is King Records not better known, if it's influential, an important part of American rock music history?
The company ended essentially in 1968 when the founder, Sid Nathan, died, And there were no heir apparents to take over the label. So the label has been in a state of limbo since around 1970. It's existed only as a reissue label, and its reissues have been fairly intermittently available and shoddily produced. So they haven't had the exposure that most of the other labels from that era have had.
What kind of label was it? A lot of record labels, especially in the earlier days of rock and pop music, specialized in a genre.
They did. King was the exception to that. King specialized in what Sid Nathan called music for the little man. And they basically did every kind of vernacular American music, what we would call roots music. They did bluegrass, country, blues, rhythm and blues, black gospel, jazz, ethnic music. Anything that he thought would sell, he would put out.
Did that make it hard for them to do business or harder for them to do business, given that they had both black and white musicians on the roster back in the 40s, 50s, early 60s?
I don't think so. I think it actually helped them because part of the reason they got into black music in the first place, they started as a country label. They realized that they were leaving a lot of money on the table, that a lot of stores stocked all kinds of music, and why shouldn't they put out all kinds of music? So I think it helped them more than it hurt them because the different kinds of artists fed on each other. There was a lot of intermingling at the studio, and they recorded each other's material. So I think it was a real positive for the label.
John Hartley Fox is author of King of the Queen City, The Story of King Records. It's an influential record label in American music history. He's a Sacramento resident. The book is published tomorrow. You chose three songs for us that are good, representative, important songs from the King record label catalog. Let's start with Good Rockin' Tonight by Wynonie Harris. Let's listen to it and then we'll talk about it. How old is that song and why is it important?
That song was recorded by Wynonie Harris in 1948, and it was subsequently re-recorded 6 years later by Elvis Presley in 1954, became one of his first hits, and became one of the first teen anthems of rock. But the song itself, the record, is important because many people, myself included, feel that it's the first rock and roll record. It's the first record on which everything that came to be called rock and roll came into play on one record.
Can you say what was different about the song, why it was different from the other songs at the time that might have sounded a little bit similar, that made this the first rock and roll record?
I think primarily the combination of ingredients. Rock and roll came out of blues music, black gospel, country, and bluegrass. And King was one of the only record companies in America that had all of those kinds of music on the label and had all of those kind of musicians working at the label in the house band. I think this, more than most of its contemporaries that might also vie for that title, combined those ingredients in a new and different way. This was one of the first rhythm and blues songs that white teenagers got into. And that really was the important thing about it. This was one of the first crossover records that began to show the potential for what could happen when white and blacks came together in the pursuit of music.
John Hartley Fox is author of King of the Queen City. The second song you picked for us is by the Delmore Brothers. It's called Blue Stay Away From Me. Let's listen to a bit of it.
Blue.
It's a mournful blues, but it's a country song. Why did you choose this one?
Well, this was one of the biggest country records of 1949, but the reason I chose it was because, to me, it perfectly illustrates the colorblind aspect of King's music. This song was a song that came together in the studio, a collaboration between the Delmore brothers, Alton and Raben Delmore, musicians from North Alabama, Wayne Rainey, a young musician from Arkansas, and Henry Glover, who was second in command at King Records, a black musician, arranger, producer, songwriter. And it was Henry who produced this record and co-wrote it and steered it in the groove that it went. It was intended as sort of a country version of a popular R&B song then called the Hucklebuck. And this was designed to be the country equivalent, the country answer to that. But it was just sort of emblematic of the way King did business. They thought nothing of having Henry Glover, a black man who lived in New York City, coming in to work with these artists from Alabama, Texas. Thought nothing about that, and Henry thought nothing about it. And apparently, most of the musicians thought nothing about it. And Cincinnati at that time was not at all a progressive place racially. It really was an unusual situation there that they all took for granted as just business as usual. But it really wasn't. It was one of the things that revolutionized the music industry itself, the integration of the record label.
Another artist on the King Records label was the young James Brown. Here's I Got You, I Feel Good.
I feel good. I knew that I would not. So good, so good. I got a year. Oh, I feel nice. A sugar and spice.
Still an amazingly fresh nice song, but it's a pretty old song. Was that an aberration, that sound that came out of King Records, this James Brown song, or was that the obvious place for him to be?
Well, that song came out in 1965, and it was an aberration. James was always an aberration. He started in fairly conventional R&B, but by the time he got up to these records for King in the 60s, he was moving to a place where the beat and the rhythm was the thing, rather than the lyrics, rather than the melody of the song. He was inventing funk music and later hip-hop in the early 60s. And in a lot of ways, it was the perfect place for him to be because it was one of the few labels that allowed artists to do pretty much as they pleased. James and Sid Nathan always had a volatile relationship, but they were very close. James was a pallbearer at Sid Nathan's funeral. And it was this was the beginning of the future for American music. This was the time of the British invasion, and James was a black act on what a lot of people still thought was a country label, but he took over the music scene in that year, 1965.
John Hartley Fox, author of King of the Queen City, The Story of King Records. It's published tomorrow. John Hartley Fox, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers were Kelly Minimar and Lynn Weaver. This is Kelly Minimar's last day with us on Insight. She's been working with us 5 days a week for the whole summer. She's an English major at Wellesley. And it's been great having her. She's contributed enormously to the program. That was interesting, wasn't it? Okay, I'm just sitting looking at this banana cream pie from Frank Fats, and I'm thinking about that too much. Anyway, thanks, Kelly, and best wishes. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard, and thank you for joining us. California's legislative session ends this week. On the next Insight, Marianne Russ tells you about what got done, what didn't, and what will happen during the recess. Also, the painstaking restoration of a rare locomotive in the Sierra foothills, plus Chicago blues organist Barry Goldberg, and the newly remastered and reissued Beatles catalog on Sound Advice. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.